Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
You are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who create fine art with needle and thread.
Oh, I'm so glad we're back to that as opposed to the angry stabbing.
Well, but and we have to because our guest this week is one of the best creators of fine art with needle and thread, Gayanne Rogers. Hi, Gayanne.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This is fun.
It's a new experience for me.
That's okay. We'll have you on two or three times, and then it won't be new. How's that? We can do that. So, okay, the other day we talked,
yes.
And you got my wheels spinning. Because you asked the question, why did I choose the Lady Edith geometric, the Downton Abbey Lady Edith geometric over the other ones, because you said that one...
No, I meant over anything, why you seem to like that one. I'm always curious about what attracts somebody to something.
Okay, well, yeah, and my initial reaction was the color and that there was a nice challenge, but I heard you, in my mind, it was over, why did I choose that over the other geometrics from Downton Abbey? And so I was thinking about that, and you know, I thought there's got to be more than just the color, because I could just change the color. You know, that's not a big deal. And I was on a bike ride yesterday, and thinking about that, and you know, I think the Lady Edith for me, there's got to be a reason, and I think it's because that one I chose because I related more to her in the Downton Abbey series and what she went through.
Well, that's interesting.
That's an interesting reason. I agree.
I really do.
I particularly like that costume of hers. I loved some of her clothes. I was just attracted to the Downton Abbey clothes. I thought they were wonderful. 20s style, which I adore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now that you mention it, though, as I'm thinking about the show, because we were huge fans. I mean, we went to Highclere and actually... You know, my husband and I have a big connection to the show and that place and all of those things, but Edith's costumes were all sort of in that colorway, weren't they? They were all in these peach and sort of ivory colors. You know, that seemed to be her color story.
I think in part, I think the other thing they did was blur her out a bit so that they were sort of misty. And I loved that look. I just loved,
yes.
I think they captured that just beautifully. In fact, all the way through the program.
Yeah. Yeah. The costume design. And it's interesting. I think that people pay close attention to costume design, especially in period pieces, from a historical perspective, as far as are the pieces true to the history? Are they appropriate? Are the fabrics and the notions appropriate and things like that? But color is important, too. And I don't know that that many people would even have the knowledge to know whether a color would be appropriate for a period of time, especially once you get past the era of color photography. But aside from that, and I think I first became aware of this watching Mad Men, because there was a really good blogger that went through the whole sort of dissection of the series, where different colors worn by different people at different times very much signified emotion or plot development or other things, like something as simple as if this character is wearing a dress with roses on it, you know that there's going to be some sort of romantic failure, and sure as anything, that's exactly what would happen. So it's fun to watch that, and as I watched Gary stitching the piece, I started thinking about Edith and all of Edith's sort of emotional ties were all of these very washed out, peachy, fleshy kind of colors. And so it was really neat that you picked up on that. And I don't even know if it was intentional, but that's exactly what it was.
I think that's deliberate all the way through all
Absolutely.
Of these programs. They set the mood with this thing or that thing. And I just went through, I just Googled all the costumes and picked three I liked, one for each of the people. And I liked, you know, I think my favorite was probably the Countess's, but that's just, I love white work. So
Yes.
And I thought it was evocative of white work, and I thought she dressed that way sort of all the through the program. I had fun doing that series. I thought, oh, I wish I'd done it a year earlier. You know, when we were all in the height of the fever, but such is life.
Yeah, well, hey. They and they're I mean, I've just done the one. I kind of kicked myself when I got it and was stitching it halfway for not buying the others when they were on
Yeah.
sale. And
There'll be lots of others. I don't know that there'll be any more Downton Abbey, but there will be something that I will. In fact, I have a really good idea. I'm not talking about it much. I'm just excited about it and want to get on with it. And it's back to historical dress, the patterns of it. And I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yeah.
But I've kept it absolutely a secret. I'm trying to get my husband involved in it. But, you know, I think, Gary, I told you that he writes for me. And does a good job of when I do historical stuff, but he gets fed up at times and quits. And right now he's in a quit phase. It all evolved. I have to tell this story because it's one of my favorite. That he, do you know, Catherine the Great was a figure that was big in his teaching career. And so he wrote about her life. And I said, you know, Jim, this is like not appropriate at all. So you better stop. He said, I'm not whitewashing Catherine for anybody.
No,
I quit.
Good
he
for
quit.
Him.
Just walked off and that was the end of it, almost mid-sentence. It was funny. He's come back since, kind of, which is nice.
Can't take the edge off of it, so he wants nothing to do with it. Okay.
He likes to do things his way. I suppose we all do, don't we?
Yeah. Sooner or later, yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
I was interested. I went last night and listened to a couple of the podcasts that you've done, and I found them really interesting. I found some of the things about them very interesting. And one of them was the emphasis on design. And, you know, that's what I'm interested in. I'm less interested in the stitches or the threads. I'm interested in them only as they service the design idea I have. And I noticed that I think in today's needlework that gets lost a lot, so that sometimes I feel the trend is towards so much going on in the canvas that I look at them and think I see a little voice in there going, help, help, let me out, says the design.
Yeah, it you know, it's it as you're saying that, there's Gary and I used to do we used to keep reef aquariums back a few years ago, and there was an exact parallel to that. In that people would sometimes, in the excitement of wanting to, you know, they'd see a piece of coral, and corals are every color, every texture, you know, just an abundance of variety. And what you would end up doing is if you can make the parallel that your canvas is like your tank and it's a flat surface, you would want to fill it with every new thing that you saw,
right,
because they were
absolutely
all so exciting. And so what we would call those would be, What did we used to call them? Like
fruit stand
yes,
aquariums.
Fruit stands.
Yep.
That's exactly right. We
yep.
call them fruit stands, because when you walk into like the front of in New York City, the fruit stands that you would see is every color, every texture, every fruit. You know, you'd have 40 different fruits and only two of them, two of each fruit, and it made no sense at all. But you saw all of them at once, and that's great if you're choosing fruit, but not so great if you're trying to create a picture or an aquarium. And the most beautiful aquariums were ones where you would allow two or three things to grow into maturity. So you'd have big swaths of color and swaths of texture and motion. And I think that it's a great parallel, because in some pieces, you're right, you do end up having an abundance of, you know, let me see how many different types of stitches I can fit and different types of fibers and colors and all those things. And you end up with sometimes a fruit stand, except for I think sometimes it becomes an intentional design element where you're doing almost a sampler, like almost like a quilting one, where I've seen people do almost like quilt sampler pieces. And then I think when it becomes an intentional thing, then I think it works. But when it just becomes a, you know, let me see how many things I can do at once, I agree. I think it can be overwhelming, and you lose the beauty of each of the stitches or the beauty of the design, So I was just looking at the Countess piece, and what struck me immediately about that was that it's the opposite of that. That even before we started this conversation, that it's the simplicity of it is what's beautiful. It's a few colors. It's one design that's allowed to grow into its maturity and be itself. Does
I
that make
think you,
sense?
yes, and I think you almost have to have resting places. I
Yes,
always think of
yes.
it as if you stand in a valley, a hill looks higher than if you stand next to the hill. So
Yes,
you've
it's
got
true.
to have some relief. You've got to have a focal point, and then you've got to have the support. Everything else in the piece has to be the supporting elements to the focal point, to my way of thinking. And I think it gets so cluttered, but I also think that's partly a generational thing. And by that, I don't mean age. I mean time that we taught. I taught for the guilds in a while ago. I was the last, you know, I'm not the present generation. I was the last generation of teachers. And I think our work was cleaner. I think that the lines were cleaner. And I think now the tendency, the fashion has become, particularly in painted canvases, it's become if you can just do all these things in it. And it makes it exciting for the stitcher because they're not repeating a whole lot of things, but I think it gets awfully cluttered in the end result. That's just.
Do you think that so that raises an interesting question too. So when you're designing a teaching piece, and I'm thinking from the perspective of if I'm looking at an upcoming seminar and I'm looking at all the different
Right.
offerings, do you think that you end up trying to design a teaching piece that has, 20 different stitches or 20 different techniques in it because it'll be more appealing to someone? Because they'll say, oh, I'll learn so much more with this piece than another piece that might have, two or three things that aesthetically perhaps will produce a prettier piece, but won't have as many teaching elements in it. So I almost wonder if a teaching piece might not be as aesthetically pleasing, but it serves a better purpose as a teaching piece. So the two things may not actually work in tandem, right? A good teaching piece may not be a good aesthetic piece that you would want on your wall. You may not choose the same. It's hard to create one piece that serves both masters, if that makes sense.
It does, except I think I have a suggestion for that. Rather than clutter up the piece, rather than, you're right, people do like to learn lots of things. Why not present alternatives so that you present a clean piece and you say to a class, you could do this, or you could do this, or you could do this. Try it on a doodle and choose one and see what happens. And of course, then everything else has to react off that. You can't change one element of a design without it influencing everything else.
I think that's a great idea. And what I like even better about that is that by making someone make one choice and forcing them then to on their own make further choices, you're making them do the hardest thing, which is to choose things, right? That's having people deviate from a design sometimes is the hardest thing for people to do.
With my followers, it doesn't happen. They want it exactly the way I have it.
Right,
And
exactly.
I have tried and tried and tried and tried. I've said over and over again, you know, Gary, I thought in this when you were talking in one of the podcasts about perfection, I hate to tell you it is never going to happen. Or at least I've never seen it yet. And sometimes the mistakes you make, this is a hard sell, but this is something I've always tried to do. Imagine that you've made a mistake and you think, oh God, it's a horrible mistake. I've got to rip it out. Before you rip it out, stop and think about it. Is there a way that I can leave my mistake, have it influence the visuals of the piece, and begin to incorporate the mistake in the design element itself, perhaps by repeating it, perhaps by building around it? And I find some of the things I've done, I've loved doing that. I try hard not to just rip. I mean, I rip 3/4 of my time, I think. But I try and look at it and think, is there a way, is there a hidden message in this? Is there a way that this came into my life because I should look at it in a different light and try and switch my gears? And often it's true. I once did a sampler and I made a mistake. I started at the bottom, started at the top, and worked, and all of a sudden I didn't have the amount of space I needed left. And I thought, oh, well, what do I do now? So I flipped through lots of visual things and found an element I really liked that was smaller than the element I'd originally intended. I incorporated it in it. It dominated the piece, and I named the piece for it. It's something that I like to do. There's a freedom to doing it that's not hemming you in as much as a fixed piece. And I'm talking against the very nature of my little business, as mine is all about do this here, do that there, do this here, do that there. But I often encounter people, and I treasure them, who make small, just little judgments. And so it makes the piece become their own, not mine any longer. I think of myself as wanting to be the architect and building the studs, and then you fill in the differences. In an ideal world, doesn't happen, but in an ideal world, that's what I would really like to do.
Okay, so the next time I make a mistake after I say all the evil words and throw things,
Right.
then I have to look for how can I incorporate that mistake and make it work, okay?
Right. So that if you make a mistake, say that you're early in the game and you're doing a Smyrna or something. I mean, I didn't think of this ahead of time. So I'm saying you're making a Smyrna and you discover it, up at one, diagonally across two, up at three, diagonally across four, up at five, down at six. Say that you get five, instead of having to be over two threads, it's over three threads. And you think, oh, I like that. So then you go do all of them like that. That's the kind of thing I mean. So
Okay.
it's a Smyrna with a tail, and then if the tail's too long, then you think, I wonder if I went one stitch stronger, and then I tied it with a horizontal stitch, and say the vertical was it's 4 stitches long, 4 threads long instead of two. Then I think, well, it looks awfully like it's sticking up there. So then I'd add another one and then tie it down. And maybe I tie it down with something that emphasized the tie down. One time I was doing eyelets. Do you know I did an eyelet? Then I spaced it. 4 meshes, then another eyelet, spaced 4 meshes, another eyelet. Do you know there's a problem because what are you going to do? Tie off the thread or carry it behind the canvas, right? And have it show through? So I thought, you can't get away from carrying it. So I thought, instead of just trying to hide it back there, why don't I emphasize it? So I brought it up to the top and went diagonally over to the next one. So it became a part of the design element. That's the kind of thing I mean, that if you stop and think, use your brain a little bit and think, I know it's not, instead of viewing it as I made a mistake, you think, well, it's maybe not what the designer did, but maybe she didn't know what she was doing. And if I do this, it'll be a bit more interesting.
I'm gonna remember that the next time I have to carry something over, 'cause it drives me nuts.
It does. And sometimes you can make it, if you keep a flexible mind about it, you can make it become a part of the design element. So that I do that over and over. Heart, if the idea is to get people to be a little bit adventuresome about what they fill in the blanks with, then often you begin with a mistake. Somebody makes a terrible mistake. And they made it 4 motifs ago. And you think, and she says, oh, I've got a half a day's ripping. And I said, do you really need to rip? What if you added to this and this and this and this? Could you and then make that incorporate what you're doing? And it's the first stages to design, I feel. It's the first way I used to be able to get students to look at things and say, oh, I don't want to rip all this. Okay, if you don't want to rip it, what can you do with it? That's a positive thing. And it was always the way that people began, just small baby steps of designing. So then I say, another thing I say all the time to people on this question is, we look at it as black and white. We look at it like you buy the finished design and you do it exactly the way I did it, or you begin with a blank canvas. Those are the two extremes. There's all this little hidden stuff in between that you could start doing. I did the what I like about needlework. I always say there are two aspects to needlework. There's how to do it, like up at one, down at two, up at three, down at four, etc. And there's what to do with it once you know how to do it. If for me it had been only how to do it, I would have lost interest in needlework for 6 months. In 6 months, easily. It's the what to do with it once you know how to do it that's just endlessly fascinating. So give me five stitches and let me choose a handful of threads I like, but limit, you can limit me, and I could spend a year with five stitches and five threads thinking, now what could I do with this and how would it be different for that? Where would I change the line of this? What would I change the filling of that? How dense would I make it? Would I overstitch it? Would I make it sparse? And so forth and so on. Those are the things I like to deal with.
I like to, I think the smart thing here is that what ends up driving creativity, because creativity and thinking of something on your own, not even thinking of something, having the courage to do something on your own is difficult for a lot of people. But using laziness as the driver is really smart because
It is that.
many of us, myself largely included, are lazy. I will look at some, and that's oftentimes what drives leaving something and figuring out a way to work around it is just, oh, how much of this am I going to have to rip out? And how much more thread am I going to have to buy? And all right, what is the, it's going to be onerous to try to fix it to make it look like what it was, quote unquote, supposed to be. So what can I do instead? That's exactly what it is. It's truly born out of laziness. It's
It
not
is
out
to
of
the
some noble, I'm going to create something. It's just,
right.
wow, I don't want to do that again.
And then once you get used to working in this mode where it's not a mistake-filled world, it's not either right or wrong, you get it gets addictive. And so what I found with people is they begin to think, if I did this instead of that, what would happen? What would it look like? And I'm a big user of doodle canvases, so I set up a doodle beside. I include a doodle in almost all of my patterns, trying to get people to do this. Just shift a little, make it your own. That's what it's about. So that I had, I've done queens, and I wanted to, I noticed, Gary, on your list, there was a note about I do a lot of royalty. There's a story behind that. And that when I started my website, a friend of mine said to me, Gayanne, that's just like your own personal little kingdom. And I said, yes, it is, but it's not a kingdom, it's a queendom. And so ever since then, people have sent me crowns and pictures of scepters and God knows what else. And so that's why I have so much royalty, because it has to do with me being queen of my website. And I always say I'm not, it's not a democracy. It's a run by whim, and I can do what I want to do. And that's where all the royalty has come from.
That's wild, because I assumed it was living with your husband and you had a
No.
just a background of interest in royalty. That's
No,
interesting.
I actually have very little interest in royalty. I like some of the trappings of royalty. I like the patterns. One of the things after I stitched Elizabeth I, and the reason I stitched Elizabeth I was I opened a magazine one day and they were talking about, and the article had a little picture of Elizabeth I, full-length portrait, but small. And this person had used all authentic stitches. That was the selling point of this, so that it was authentic stitches. And I looked at it and I showed it to my husband just because he was around. He sort of rolls his eyes, but he humors me. And I said, look at this. You couldn't have made it to be more ugly if you wanted to, all in the name of authenticity. So I thought, why don't I might be inauthentic and pay attention to proportion, pay attention to spacing, pay attention to those things, and forget about what stitches were done back in Elizabethan times. And I have a friend, Jane Zimmerman. I don't know if you know her, but she's just a really good, she's a wonderful stitcher. She was an iconic teacher, probably worked for EGA longer than anybody else, and she was in love with Elizabeth I. So I called her up and said, I don't know what I'm doing. Will you help me? And she said, sure. So I said, should I do a dolly or should I do a portrait, formal portrait? And she said, formal portrait. And that's the reason I did what I did.
Yeah,
So
I'll
it
tell
was
you
all. It,
with those formal portraits, all the things that you have there, and they're not my kind of thing to stitch, but they amaze me. Number one, in what you're able to achieve, but the part that stands out for me every single time is how you get the faces to not look dorky. I mean, those faces, the eyes and
it's
the faces,
hard.
They have a realism to them that you just don't see in needlework as a rule.
I do. I have stitched a face 9 times, I think, to get it where I wanted it. And I do five, six times on a doodle, and then I think, okay, it's right now, and I start. So I cut off a piece of canvas, put it on the stretcher bars, get started, don't like it, trash the canvas, and start over again. And it takes me a while to get going on almost everything. So I'm a great consumer of threads, and I'm a great consumer of canvas. And personally, I start out with 6 times the amount of thread I need because I don't know where I'm going. And I like that. I treasure that aspect of it, that I don't know where I'm going, and I just get there through thread. I mean, I start with a basic drawing, but the drawing isn't the stitching itself. So I've loved to do faces forever, but my hardest one is coming up. I actually did it in 5 tries, which for me was pretty good. But it's a person, my last queen is a person that people will recognize, and she wasn't very pretty, and my audience wants pretty.
Oh, and you've been teasing this one for a while.
I have. But I thought, I didn't know if I could do it because it had to look faintly like the person. She had to be prettier than the person, and all in 32 stitches across.
Hmm. Uh-huh. Well, you put when you start doing portraits, and you really put yourself in a box in terms of...
Oh, I do.
Yeah. That's not, you can't just slop that through. You really have to deliver. That's what, every time I see one, I thought, wow, how does she do that? That's, and now we know it takes multiple times.
It does. It takes a lot. I don't usually have to spend that much time, but I like it to get it just so-so, and then I'll stitch it for real. And sometimes it comes out, and sometimes I have to start over again. It's just the way I stitch. I'm a great stitcher and ripper.
And you work from a drawing first, right?
Sort of, yes. When I was a young designer, I mapped out my drawing much more than I do now. I have a little aid now that makes life really sloppy. When I was young, I painted a lot and I drew all my life. And I love to draw, and I like to paint somewhat. I like drawing better than painting. But it takes me a couple hours to do a drawing, and then I discovered the iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil.
Uh-oh.
Now I do in 5 minutes what it used to take me 2 hours to do. But my drawings, I thought, oh, you know what? If I get this iPad Pro, it will make me return to the roots of painting and drawing more seriously. Instead, it's done the opposite. It's made me sloppier than ever. I don't like to close myself in too much because I want to think in the thread.
Yeah. Computers do that. I used to, when I had to use a typewriter, I used to be like lightning with very few errors. Now I can hit that delete key faster than you can even think about it. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's too easy to correct and move on. And
right. So, and you can get to where you want, and you can put something underneath it. There's a wonderful app called Procreate, and it just allows you to do anything and do it just lightning fast. Or you can take your time and do something worthwhile. My drawings are horrible. They've gone downhill increasingly over the years, but they locate elements and they give me a place to start. And then I like to think as I go. I don't want to know where I'm going to end up.
Hmm.
I like to take the last stitch and think, oh, this is different than I started out with it. It's just, it goes along with the whole idea of changing things and building on mistakes. I like the piece. It has a life of its own. And that fascinates me.
So was art your interest in school? I mean, just something you just do?
No. I took a lot of art classes, but it wasn't my major. Literature was my major. And I was glad I did it in that way because I spent my life doing art stuff, and the literature ends up being such a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem obvious at first, but it is really obvious to me, it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And with me as well, what area of literature did you favor or did you focus on?
I did mostly English, I think. Mm-hmm. I had a professor who was German, and so I got involved in all myths and mythologies and things like that. I really liked it. And of course, they enter into this. And it gave me my approach, I think. That and going to the British Museum. I don't know if you've ever been in the manuscript room of the British Museum, at where all the manuscripts, so you see these elegant prose, some of the best ever, and you see what a tortured life it had in getting born, and it's sort of reassuring. It always was to me. It was one of those moments when I thought, oh, look how that person went over and over and over it. So it doesn't matter if I do, does it? And
Right.
that entered into it also. That's my interest in needlework, is the design part of it. And do you know, Gary, back to your perfection, I've had maybe three pieces I'm really proud of, and the rest I look at them and think, oh, if I did that over again, I could do it so much better. And then I think to myself, no, there's never really a finished project. It's all a chain leading from one to another. So you never really finish. And if you never really finish, then you don't have to be perfect. You think, oh, I'll fix that the next time I go around. I'll pay attention to that. So it's
Okay,
just an
writing, wait a minute,
ongoing
writing
stream.
this down now.
I think we beat up on our, I think needleworkers see things in really black and white. There's no gray. And I think the difference is in the design world, it's all about the grays. It's never about how you ever get to where you think it's really wonderful. Oh, I think I could have done that differently, or I could have done that differently. And I think, okay, I'll do it the next time. So,
It's an ongoing problem for me. I'm this Carole Lake's Anasazi song I'm stitching, and I'm doing the it's a Byzantine, I think it is, stitch, and I'm laying three strands of DMC, and it's overdyed floss, and so you want to kind of keep the pattern the same on both sides of the central core. And I caught myself the other night. I was not being clean on the back, and so the threads were not coming up through the hole clean, and I was fighting to get them to lay and cover like they should. And I kept backing up and redoing and backing up and redoing, and I think I figured out what I was doing wrong. But I had to stop myself because it was my quest to have it exactly right was really just sucking the fun out of it. And
Right.
I stopped myself and said, wait a minute, these are all laying, 80, 85% good. I ought to just shut up and be happy with that and, correct it, as I go along. And because it really was, I mean, I was just sitting there getting nowhere and really getting frustrated. And then I just, it's taking the fun out of it. It's supposed to be enjoyable, not a torture session. So, yeah.
I also think one of the things that I suggest people do is go look at the first things you stitched, look at where you were halfway through your stitching journey, and look at the work you're doing now. If you're making progress, I think that's all that you can ask. I
Okay.
treasure my early things thinking, oh gosh, I'd have never made those decisions now. But I liked them then.
Yeah.
And I look to see where I grow. I think that more than the pursuit of perfection, it's a journey and a growth. And therefore, you're never finished.
Yep,
So you don't have to.
writing that down too. Okay, the notes are getting long here,
Okay,
Gayanne.
I'll be quiet.
No,
No,
no.
we've talked about dating the backs of pieces and putting little notes in, because then you can look back, and the idea of framing those early pieces, even though you know they're not perfect, because the whole idea is that they aren't perfect, and that you know that 5 years from now or a year from now you'll look back on them. And so Gary would be the person that would immediately want to take it and throw it under the bed. But to somebody like you or to somebody like me, I would look at that and say, wow, that was really not my best work, but it was my best work then. And that means something.
Well, and I think you change your mind about things. And as you change your mind and the whole evolution thing, I can tell you what I've done. I know a woman who's a scrapbooker, and she does beautiful cards. And so she makes journals, and I sell them. So that if you start one of my big projects, some of my big projects, if she's moved to do it, she makes a stitching journal, and then it goes in an envelope, and you glue the envelope to the back of the piece. And I think it keeps track of what you did, where you did, and some of your motivation. You can make all kinds of notes when you started it, when you obvious things. And then there's room where you can make notes about, you know, I found this really difficult, and maybe here's one of the way I approached it. And if you go back later and look at that, you think, oh, okay, now I've changed my mind about it. Here's where I think I am now. And I think it's just interesting.
That makes a ton of sense. Yeah, see, that's exactly the kind of thing we were talking about. I love that idea. And then it's good to revisit that over time, because you forget those little hints that you give yourself.
Right. And you forget where you were and what your thinking was. And sometimes you look back and think, oh, I wish I could think up something like that today. So you go, I wonder if I
Right.
changed it. And I think it all has to do with density anyway. I think you can use any number of patterns in something. You just have to pay attention to what they're doing to the rest of the design.
Imagine that 30 years, 40 years after you're gone, after any of us is gone, somebody opens up the back of a stitched piece and there's a little journal in there. Wow, what fun would that be?
And if you're interested in stitching, it's interesting to know where they were. You know, I did this and here's some. That's where I think my literature background comes in.
Yeah.
Is it, and it doesn't, it's not required on the piece, but a supplementary material. It's interesting about the whole creative journey. I wanted to talk in particular about an exercise I did probably about 9 years ago. And it changed the way I looked at stitching. I have hands down a favorite artist, and that's Cézanne. And the reason that I am just in awe of Cézanne has to do with his idea of shading and blocks of color. And I think that suits needlework so well. How he gets the amount of depth perception he gets with just simple lines and blocks of shading, I don't know. But he gets it. So I decided I would go on a very long 6 month journey where I would just try to reenact a couple of Cézanne pieces. The best thing I've ever done, I did as a result of it. And it changed the way I approached stitching. I just looked at the whole world of how to use stitches differently. It's become much simpler. And I've reintroduced myself to tent stitch. And I use it almost like in a painterly fashion. I think it's a painterly fashion. I have people fill in blocks of tent stitch now underneath, and then you stitch on top of the tent stitch with two or three layers. And I think personally I learned that from him.
That's interesting.
Okay, now see, I'm the last guy to know about famous artists, last guy on the planet.
Okay.
But I just looked up the Cézanne just to see what you were talking about.
Right.
Fascinating.
He was really amazing as an artist. Never, not recognized a lot in his time, except by his artist friends who collected his works. I think that's fascinating too. But now, I mean, I spent my life wanting to go to Paris and find a Cézanne drawing on a street corner. My husband assures me this is never going to happen. He said every time he applied anything to anything, it is studied today. But he's just hands down influenced the way. I mean, I wish I could do it well, but I like my tries. And the idea of layering with color has changed how, that's what enables me to do the portraits. I could have never done them before because of the layer. It's because of the interaction of color in a certain space.
Hey, and this Cézanne guy, he's pretty good.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
And the other thing is, one of the obsessions in needlework world that just drives me nuts is the obsession with correct perspective. And I would like to take the whole notion of perspective and simply throw it out. And I think that's another thing that he does, his perspective, the way he sees perspective. Look up some of his still lives. The way he sees perspective, you'll never see it the same way again. He pays no attention to it. It has its own dynamic. And so there could have never been Picasso without Cézanne.
See, this is a rabbit hole that if I were to start, I would just, yeah, I can't let myself go down this one.
That's...
I'm looking at the basket of apples. Just
Yep.
Wow.
But you look at it, look what happens to those, look at the coloring on those apples. There's
Yeah.
something, it still looks odd to me. That's the thing I love about, I mean, I spend hours going, just flipping through books of his paintings. It influences everything I do. I don't do well, but it influences everything I do. And my whole stitching has evolved. In fact, I was talking to my husband about that, saying, he notices it. He said, you've changed so much since that original landscape you did. And I have. It's just
Yeah.
influenced every part of it. Interesting. You better edit out some of
Oh, no. We'll be
this.
keeping this in. So I wanted to explore, 'cause most people in your world start out the standard way, stitching and get to be stitchers, and then, as you've described, start to play with existing designs, and then pretty soon
Right.
take a stab at your own. But you did not start out stitching.
Nope.
Yeah, tell that story about how you got a job painting needlepoint canvases, and that's what, who knew?
I got a job in the weirdest way ever. I was a knitter in my early life. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, and we were skiers, and so I knit ski sweaters. We all did. And I went looking one day. I had no idea what needlepoint was. I went shopping one day into a needlepoint store looking for yarn, and of course it wasn't the same kind of yarn I was looking for. And I got in a conversation with somebody who said, and it was in the, there was a period in the 70s where needlepoint enjoyed a huge revival, and they were desperate for people to paint. And so one of the fellows who owned the shop said to me, do you paint? And I said, well, yeah, I have. And he said, here, take this, go home, paint it, bring it in, we'll sell it. That's how I started. So it's never been a hobby for me. It was always a business. But it doesn't mean I don't love it. It's just that I stitch it. I stitch what I stitch. It's business.
Yeah. How
And
is it? How is it? So you painted that, and then when
I
did the
painted.
stitching come in? Did you say, wait a minute, let me see what happens to this if I stitch it?
No, I painted. Actually, I painted three things and brought them back to the shop, and they sold them, and this is the only famous person who's ever bought anything of mine. I had painted a pair of stork scissors on a little something or other, and Frank Sinatra bought
No.
it. But I mean, this
What a
was
weird thing.
awesome. Yes, it was a very weird thing. It was, so I painted for a while, and there was a woman in the store, and they said, we think we're going to be able to sell your things, so will you come work in here a day a week so that you learn something about it? And there was a woman who was the manager of the store, and she taught me how to do basket weave, the tent stitch, continental, and then basket weave. And she said, this will make you paint better if you understand that this is a grid and blah blah and blah blah, which all went over my head. But so I picked up a needle and I thought, oh, this is fun. I took it home and I sat up for hours stitching it. And you know what, in one of your podcasts you were talking about dimensions. I think it was a dimensions kit, but I'm not, I don't really remember. I don't have it still. I wish I did. And I finished, it was an animal print, and she picked it out for me. I didn't pick it out. She picked it out because of all the jagged edges. She wanted me to see what happened. I finished the thing, and then I thought, this would be fun to do. Then I stitched some of them. I painted myself something and stitched it. And since then, I have a hard and fast rule. I have taken a whole lot of classes, and I have started a whole lot of things, and I have piles and piles of cross stitch things, but I have never completed, except three times, anything that wasn't my own design. It's a rule of mine. I think, Christine, you were so right about laziness. I think it would be so easy to be seduced by all these beautiful things, and then when would I get my work done? So I have a hard and fast rule that if I'm going to work it all the way through to completion, it has to be something I drew. So after that, so I learned to stitch. I learned how to do, I don't know, remember in those days whether I did anything but continental and basket weave. But my husband had, by then, my husband probably 3 or 4 years after I, maybe 3 years, maybe 4 years, I don't remember. He got a grant. He got a really prestige grant to go to Cambridge And there he was a part of a team exploring Darwinism. They were reading Darwin's letters, and he was the Russian expert for the Darwin letters at Cambridge for a year. And during that time, I thought, well, what am I going to do with myself? So I signed up for and went to the Royal School of Needlework. And I had a different experience from the
Okay,
experience
wait a
that the
minute. Wait a minute.
staff
Most people,
described.
most people, that's like a life goal.
Right. And you're
For
like,
you, it
well,
was I got to have something to do, so I'll go there. Okay.
no, I was interested in going there. I'd heard about it. Now, remember, this was a whole long time ago. It was early enough that somebody on one of your podcasts was talking about going to Hampton Court for the. I went to the Royal School of Needlework before it went to Hampton Court. It was still in Prince's Gate. And you have to understand, I was living probably 4 blocks away. So I went there, but it was a different program. Earlier, it had been a really rigorous program, and the people who came out of it were like Marion Schooler and some Brits that I knew. And instead, it was in the early stages of the revival of needlepoint. So they hired one of their own graduates to teach classes that were 3 sessions long, essentially for Americans. Trying to capitalize on Americans coming over to go to the Royal School of Needlework. It was unrigorous. It's nothing like it was earlier. It was nothing like it was later on. And ultimately, I stayed for about three, four, I don't remember how long, a whole lot of months I stayed. I can't remember, there's once or twice a week. And they fired my teacher because she had it was an acid ton Brit. I mean, there were those. And she would raise her eyebrows and she would make the American ladies who didn't have a thick skin cry. So they
Ooh.
fired her. And I looked at the Royal School of Needlework and what was there. And I looked at my instructor who got a job teaching Japanese, interestingly enough. And for years afterwards, I just went to her. And people said to me, did she teach you how to stitch? And I say, no, she didn't teach me how to stitch. I knew kind of how to stitch. But she refined what I did and she still sits on my shoulder.
Yeah.
She had different ideas. She absolutely refined what all the way through my own needlework. First thing I did going there, and interestingly, was she sent me down to Portobello Road and told me to buy a copy of Weldon's. There's an old encyclopedia. And I remember I paid £8 for it, which was probably in those days about $16. And she just chewed me out. She said, you paid too much. You're ruining it for everybody else. You should have paid no more than £6. I said, sorry. So she used that as a textbook. And then she just went through, and I would have, she was wonderful because I'd bring in my own drawings. I didn't have to work on anything set. And she'd say, well, do, you know, try this, or I'd do stitch something. And she'd say, have you thought of doing it that way or this way, or suggest something that doesn't really accomplish where you're going and things like that. So she really refined what I did. So I stayed years, we went back years and years. In fact, we were there for a total of about 12 years. I mean, not all together, but in spurts and starts. And I stayed, I always picked up with her again and took lessons from her. I go to her Japanese classes. Japanese colony at the, I don't know if this is still true, but then there were a big Japanese colony in London. And my husband commuted. We lived in London and my husband commuted. And for the English think that's insane. Probably some of you would too. But remember, we lived in LA.
Yeah.
Going crossing was
That's a
no
big
big
deal.
deal. So I then went to her class. The big Japanese colony hired her to teach needlework. She didn't speak any Japanese. They didn't speak any English, but they got fine together. She got the job done. And so it was interesting on two aspects for me, but that was really how that was the beginning of me looking at needlework as something besides just a little painting I sold in a needlework store. Then I got an order. Then I had a little painting business, and I got an order from somebody. And she ordered, I painted a thimble can ornament, and she ordered a gross of them. And she thought I'd be delighted. And I said, you know, give me overnight to think about it. So I thought about it and I called her back and said, I don't want to do it. It's too much. I don't want to paint 144 canvases that thimble. And I quit, put down my paintbrush and never picked it up again.
Ah, I'll be darned.
So then I got hooked on counter work. I mean,
Yeah.
I was gradually getting hooked on counter work anyway.
So that ended the painting of canvases right there.
That ended my painting business. You've got to understand, this was probably, I'm trying to think of when I painted my last canvas, probably before 1980.
Oh my.
So we're talking about way back there, and styles have changed.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my story.
Okay, well, that's a good story. I think we'll end right there, I think.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, because if we start the next one, see, it's going to be another hour. And,
oh, no, that's fine.
Yeah, so that just means that then you have to come back. So
I'd love to come back.
Yeah,
we do. We have to talk about the October pieces.
Yes.
So we will have to have another one.
I would like you to come. I would like to talk about my last queen, who's coming out on August 10th.
When is that? August 10th?
August 10th, my last queen's coming.
Okay, well, that's when you're coming back then, right there. Okay. It's a date.
So maybe the 12th or the 14th or whatever.
Perfect. All right.
It's a date. Right. That's when we're doing it.
Thank you so much.
Gan, it was a treat. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll be back on Wednesday.